Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before I begin this talk, I just want to say first, so a word of thanks, and then just a brief exhortation. So the word of thanks is, it's really a pleasure for me to be here. This is my second time speaking here at the University of Edinburgh, and I was absolutely, fantastically, phenomenally charmed my first visit here. So it's a joy for me to be back with you. The exhortation is this. So raise your hand for anybody in the audience who has been present in the past for any of Dr. Daniel DeHaan's talks. Okay, so anyone who has been present for Dr. DeHaan's talks, I really want to strongly encourage you, reach out to him by email to tell him how much better this talk is. Okay. So the talk that I want to give you all this evening is titled Truth, Goodness, and Fantasy Literature, Thomistic Reflections on the Rise of a Subgenre. And there is a more focused kind of question that I want to discuss and get to. Roughly, it goes like this. Is J.R.R. Tolkien better than George R.R. Martin? Right? That's the question. So the plan for the talk is pretty simple. First, I want to just introduce you guys and reflect with you a little bit on recent trends in fantasy literature. Then I want to introduce you to the basic subtleties involved in Thomas Aquinas' account of both truth and goodness. And then I want to apply that account to art in general, but with a view towards fantasy literature in particular, and with this focused comparison between Tolkien and Martin. So first, reflections on recent fantasy literature. Whoops, there we go. So it's undeniable that since the time of Tolkien, fantasy literature has developed in pretty significant ways. And in particular, what we've seen is a vast multiplicity and multiplication of subgenres within fantasy, right? When Tolkien was writing, there wasn't even such a thing as fantasy literature. There were fairy stories, right? There was myth. So the fantasy genre itself was developing. Now what we've seen is a really incredible growth in subgenres. So here are some subgenres, right? We now, fantasy nerds tend to distinguish between low fantasy, historical fantasy, mythic fantasy, magical realism, et cetera, et cetera. Here's another set of subgenres, right? So there's lit RPG fantasy, there's Weird West fantasy, there's occult detective fantasy, right? I mean, there are as many fantasy subgenres as you could possibly want, right? We have certainly let a thousand flowers bloom, right? Now, we can introduce a little bit of order into this chaos of subgenres. And so there are certain ways of dividing the genres of fantasy literature that are common today. So one division is based on magic, right? Everyone knows that fantasy literature involves magic, right? But does it involve lots of magic or only a little bit of magic? If it's lots, that's high fantasy. If it's only a little, that's low fantasy. A very different way of dividing subgenres is based on the setting in, like, where does the plot occur or take place? So otherworldly fantasy are fantasy novels that take place entirely or completely in a separate reality or on a separate world. Portal fantasies are fantasies where the main characters travel from the real world, our world, to a fantasy world. Think Narnia, right? The wardrobe is the portal, right? Urban fantasies take place in a city. Historical fantasies, right? The setting is an alternate version of the past. And then contemporary fantasies are fantasies where the setting is an alternative version of the present. There are also divisions of subgenre that are based on characters. So you have the Bildungsroman, right, the coming of age fantasy, where the main character grows from childhood to adulthood. So you might think of the Chronicles of Prydain here. You have anti-heroic fantasy, where the main character has really, really, really deep character flaws. And it's just worth noting that all of these various genres can, or many of these various genres can overlap and often do in the literature. So you can have a high anti-heroic portal fantasy, right? That's like Stephen R. Donaldson's Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever. So he goes from, he's a leper who goes from this world to another world where he is healed and has like a psychotic break because he doesn't know how to deal with being able to feel things anymore, right? But there are like, there's like a lot of magic. So it's high fantasy, right? You can have high urban historical fantasy. This is probably one of my favorites books ever, right? So Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell takes place in a very weird version of Victorian England. You can have low contemporary coming of age fantasy. So like Water for Chocolate would be a great example of this, where, and this probably is like the confluence of subgenres that is where people are least likely to even call it fantasy, or maybe they'll just call it magical realism or something. But you can just iterate, right? Any ways that you want these things to overlap, you can do it, and you can probably find an example of it having already been done, or multiple examples. For tonight, I want to focus our attention on what I'm going to suggestively call a troubling subgenre. So one of the subgenres amidst this vast panoply is the subgenre that's called grimdark fantasy. So grimdark fantasy, most people agree that sort of the text for grimdark fantasy is Glenn Cook's 1984 book, The Black Company. There's the really hideous first cover. But the most famous example of grimdark fantasy is without a doubt George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones. Basically everyone is familiar with Game of Thrones, at least from the TV series, right? But pretty much any kind of fantasy, real fantasy fan is aware of the books and has probably at least read some of them. But the subgenre has continued to develop. So in 2006, Joe Abercrombie wrote a really influential book called The Blade Itself. In 2008, Richard Morgan wrote The Steel Remains. In 2011, Mark Lawrence wrote The Prince of Thorns. And then as recently as 2020, Rob Hayes has Along the Razor's Edge. So this is a flourishing subgenre within fantasy literature. What is it? Well, you know, philosophers are known for just coming up with definitions on their own. I'm going to spare you my own definitions or descriptions, and I'm just going to give you some definitions or descriptions of grimdark fantasy that have been provided by actual fantasy authors, right, who probably know what they're talking about better than I do. So M.K. Jemisin, who's, I mean, one of the most lauded, awarded fantasy authors today, has a very pithy characterization of grimdark. She says, grimdark fantasy is dark, broken worlds with dark, broken characters. Adam Roberts, no, that is not Robert Adams. Adam Roberts describes grimdark fantasies as fantasies that turn their backs on the more uplifting pre-Raphaelite visions of idealized medievalia, and instead stress how nasty, brutish, short, and this is a direct quote, and he has dark life was really back then. And in the context of the quote, it's clear that Roberts intends that as scare quotes, right? So he himself doesn't think that grimdark fantasy is any more realistic than the pre-Raphaelites, right? In exactly the same way that, I mean, you look at any pre-Raphaelite painting and, you know, everything's got this sort of like warm halo-like glow to it, right? Roberts is pretty convinced that the grit of grimdark fantasy is just as unrealistic as the halo of the pre-Raphaelites. Michael Sullivan describes grimdark fantasy this way. He says, these are novels where all the characters seem mired in a morass of hopelessness. Their lives are weighed down by misery. There is no possibility for joy and no reason to aspire to anything because in the end, there is no chance of a better life or a greater good. And lastly, Liz Bork gives a description and then what looks like an actual definition. So she says, look, grimdark is a subgenre that values its gritty realism and that attempts to overturn long-established heroic tropes. Now, note, its defining characteristic lies in a retreat into the valorization of darkness for darkness's sake, into a kind of nihilism that portrays right action in terms of personal morality as either impossible or futile. So if any of you want to say, that's not grimdark, right? I know better what grimdark is. Nolo contendere, right? All I'm going to say, right, is if you disagree with these actual living current fantasy authors, that's on you, right? So for my sake, right, I'm just going to operate for the rest of this talk as if they're basically right, because I don't particularly think that I've got the authority to disagree with them. So I'm going to take this as kind of authorities in the field, the self-reporting on the state of the field as it stands right now. So the core question that I want to raise and answer with you guys tonight is this. As characterized, is grimdark fantasy less true, less good than other fantasy subgenres? And in particular, than classic fantasy, which has Tolkien as its paragon? That's the question. And in fact, we can divide this into two sub-questions. Sub-question one, is grimdark fantasy less true than other fantasy subgenres? And in particular, than classic fantasy. Sub-question two, is it less good than classic fantasy? Those are our questions. Now, my gut answer, just being super candid and transparent with you guys, is yes, right? I'm a Tolkien lover. I'm a Catholic priest, right? You know, I have lots of reasons for being like predisposed to be anti-grimdark fantasy, right? So my gut says yes. But it doesn't always happen that my gut and my reasoned philosophical Thomistic position on things are one and the same. So that's really the question for me. What should my or our reasoned philosophical Thomistic answers or principled answer to these sub-questions be? I'm a philosopher, right? So I'm committed, like according to my day job, right, that we can do better than what our gut tells us. So for the rest of this talk, let's do better than just what our gut tells us. And to do better, I'm going to surprise no one and turn to Thomas Aquinas, and in particular to Aquinas's accounts of truth and goodness, precisely because those correspond to our two sub-questions, right? If we want to know whether one thing is less true than another, it would be super helpful to know what truth is. And if we want to know whether one thing is less good than another, it would be super, super helpful to know what goodness is. So first, some definitions, and you can take these as working definitions. So first, Aquinas says, Truth is the correspondence of thing and intellect, or the correspondence between mind and thing. And goodness is that which satisfies desire. Right? So now note, these are like pretty wide tent, like broad tent, wide net definitions. You don't have to have like significant metaphysical commitments to these, right? Like the extent of your metaphysical commitments for this account of truth is just that there is such a thing as a mind and there is such a thing as a thing. And as long as you've got the difference between mind and thing, you can make sense. You can work with this definition of truth. Even if you downstream might disagree with it or something like that, it's a pretty good working definition. Likewise, what satisfies desire? Notice he's not telling you, right? Like this is not Thomas Aquinas saying like, it's God, right? Because here, now, God does satisfy desire, but here's something else that satisfies desire. Cake. Here's something else that satisfies desire, right? Like the steak that I just had for dinner, right? Scotland, you guys are doing good, right? When it comes to steak, right? So just something is good to the extent that it satisfies desire. Something is true to the extent that it corresponds with intellect or mind. Now, for any Thomists in the room, there's going to be a deep-seated temptation for you, right? So Thomas Aquinas has this theory of these things called the transcendentals. And Thomists like to make a big, big deal of them, right? So transcendentals are usually characterized as features or traits or attributes or properties that belong to absolutely every being. And so here's one, right? Every being is a unity, right? If you're thinking about something that is a being, you're thinking about something that has some kind of unity to it, right? And vice versa, every unity is in some sense a being. Also among the transcendentals are numbered truth and goodness. So the idea is everything that is good. Everything that's good is. Everything that is in some sense true. And everything that's true in some sense is. And like I said, Thomists make a lot of the transcendentals. Tonight we will not. Because if that's the sense of truth and goodness that we're thinking about, the sense in which everything corresponds to the intellect, just insofar as it's being, and everything can satisfy desire, just insofar as it's being, right? So just think about it, right? There's some way, pick anything, right? The thing that you hate most, cats, right? You can be certain, right, that even something as terrible as a cat, I'm looking at you, Emma, right? Even something as terrible as a cat, you can find something good about it, right? It exists, right? It, for some inscrutable reason, it was made by God, right? So like for some inscrutable reason, it is loved by single ladies, right? You know, et cetera, right? Like there's something good about it, which just is to say that there's, oh yeah, by the way, so probably half of you are going to be deeply offended systematically throughout this talk. So just brace yourself. Okay. So there's some sense in which literally everything that is has some aspect of desirability to it. And literally everything that is can correspond to the mind, right? It can be known. And so in that sense, it can be true. But if that's the sense of truth and goodness that we're working with, then the answer to our core question is like obviously and trivially no. Grimdark fantasy is not less true or less good than classic fantasy if the sense of truth and goodness is the transcendental sense. Why? Because the whole point of transcendental truth and transcendental goodness is that literally everything that there is satisfies them, right? Everything that exists is true. Grimdark fantasy exists. Ergo, grimdark fantasy is true. Everything that exists is good. Grimdark fantasy exists. Ergo, grimdark fantasy is good, right? And I can do the same arguments for classic fantasy and get the same conclusions. So if this is what we mean by truth and goodness, then the answer is, then the question is uninteresting, and the answer is trivial. And trivially, no. But, happily, St. Thomas also recognizes other, and I want to suggest to you, more important senses of truth and goodness that are not transcendental, right? Such that not everything is going to be equally true and equally good. And so it's those senses of truth and goodness, the narrower and I want to suggest more significant senses that are relevant for our question. So here's what St. Thomas says in, he wrote a work on truth. He says, something is related to the practical intellect, so the mind thinking practically, differently then it's related to the speculative intellect, so the mind thinking theoretically. For the practical intellect causes the thing, and so is the measure of the things that it brings about. But the speculative intellect, because it receives from things, is in a way moved by those things, and so the things are the measure of it. From this, it's clear that the natural things from which our intellects, our human intellects, acquire knowledge, measure our intellect. So what's he saying here? So to continue with the cat theme, right? And this is, I think, maybe, Emma, the first time I ever met you, this was the example that I gave. And so I made an enemy of her day one. So look, if you want to know the truth about cats, there has to be a correspondence between mind and thing, right? And the thing in question is the cat. So the way that we think about cats has to correspond with the cat, and the cat has to correspond with the way that we're thinking about it if there's going to be true thought. So the nature of cats is objective and external to us. Right? We can't change what it is to be a cat, right? We can't change. So here's something that's objective about cats, right? It's part of the nature of cats that they are the sorts of things that meow, right? Dogs don't meow. Birds don't meow, right? Like, you might be able to get a parrot to imitate a meow, but an imitation meow is not a meow, right? Because a meow is the sound a cat makes, right? So not a cat, not a meow, right? Here's another objective fact, right, that's just made true by the nature of cats, right? There's an inverse proportion, an inverse correlation between the number of cats owned and the likelihood of a woman getting married, right? Number goes up, likelihood goes down, right? Like, that's just the way that God made cats, right? So now, it's funny because you can tell the difference, right? There are certain truths about cats that really are determined by the nature of what a cat is. And there are certain truths that are not, right? Even though they're still true. So what Aquinas is saying here is, when we're engaged in speculative thought, right? When we're trying to understand, when we're doing like felinology, right? The thing that we're studying has to be the measure of the mind, right? Our thinking about the thing has to measure up to the thing itself. And when our thinking about it measures up, we think truly. When it doesn't measure up, we think falsely. But it's different in the case of practical thought. When you're thinking about how to make a door, right? Suppose you're a carpenter, right? And you come in, somebody's building a house, right? They bring you in to make the doors for all the houses, right? You're thinking about how to make the door and what the door should be, and the door can fail to measure up to what you have in mind. When it fails to measure up to what you have in mind, the door is not the true door that you were intending to make. right? It falls short of the measure that is your mind. So when we're engaged in practical kind of factive thinking, the mind is the measure and the thing is measured by the mind. So it's not that the thing isn't true. It's not that there's no truth or falsity in practical matters. It's just that the measure of truth or falsity is different. So for the speculative intellect, the mind receives information from the natural thing and needs to measure up to the truth of the natural thing, what the natural thing is. Whereas in practical thought, it's the reverse. The mind is the cause of the thing. And so the artificial thing, the thing made, has to measure up to the mind of the maker. If it does, then the thing is true. If it doesn't, the thing is in some sense false, right? It's not what you intended, right? Look, we've all taken that like horrifying and traumatic Art 101 class, right? Where, you know, you sit in front of the canvas and you work for like a while, and then you take a step back and there's just this moment of horror, right? And you say, that is not what I intended, right? That painting is in a very, very real sense false with respect to what you had in mind. It is not a true representation of what you were trying to represent. So for practical matters, the thing has to measure up to the mind. In speculative matters, the mind has to measure up to the thing. Big chunky quote, I apologize. In the same text, Aquinas says this. He says, so adds layers of nuance. Natural things are themselves measured by the divine mind, in which all things are like artifacts in the mind of the artificer. Thus, one, the divine mind is a measure of things, the things it makes, but is not itself measured. The natural thing is both a measure and measured. And then third, our minds are measured by and not a measure of natural things. But our minds are measures of artificial things. And so we can think of the natural world as standing in between two intellects, two minds. And so it can be called true in two different ways. Right? So the natural thing is called true insofar as it corresponds either to the divine intellect, in which case it's true to the extent that it does what it was ordained to do by God. But a natural thing can also be true in the sense that it corresponds to a human mind. And then what we mean is when we say that it's true, we mean that it is sort of apt to cause a true judgment or a true thought about itself, and false to the extent that it's apt to cause a false judgment. So think about this. We distinguish between true gold and false gold. What's the difference? True gold is apt to make us make judgments about it that correspond to what it actually is. False gold is the kind of thing that is apt to make us misjudge, right? It's a different kind of mineral than the thing that we actually think that than it is. So you get this cascading level of differences. On the cosmic level, you've got the divine practical mind causing natural things. And so the things are true insofar as they measure up to God's plan for it, right? And so we can say, and this is actually a profound point, right? So you are most truly yourself when you live up to the idea or the plan that God has for you. And you are false to yourself, right? You are living a maximally inauthentic life the more you deviate from the perfect plan that God has for you. And we in our freedom can deviate, right? So God doesn't force us to be the maximally true to ourselves. He lets us deceive ourselves and lie to ourselves. There's a very different relationship when we think about human speculative or theoretical thought. Here, it's the natural thing outside in the world that measures the mind, and we have to, in a kind of epistemic humility, submit ourselves to objective reality. We have to accept that the world around us, the natural world, has truths. There are natures to things, and we can think rightly or think wrongly about the natures of things. Third, in a kind of parallel to the first tier, you have the sphere of human creativity. Right? When we are thinking practically, when we're thinking creatively, our minds are the causes of the things that we create in a kind of analogous way to the way that God's mind is the cause of the natural physical world. And in this case, the truth of the created thing, the creation, comes from its measuring up to the mind of the person exercising creativity, right? So the better a fit between what you're trying to express with that painting and what the painting actually expresses, the truer the painting is. The worse the fit between what you're trying to express with the painting, what it was painted to express, and what it in fact succeeds in expressing, right? The falser the painting is. Okay, that's truth. Now goodness. So in the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas says that God alone is good by his essence, which means that everything else that is good by participation. And he explains. So for each thing, right, each created thing is called good insofar as it is perfect. But the perfection of a thing is threefold. So we can think about kind of three tiers or three levels of perfection for things. First, just insofar as the thing exists, right? Existing, being is a perfection of things. It is better to be than not to be. Second, and more importantly, things are perfected to the extent that they have the accidents, the kind of proper traits or features necessary for their perfect operations. So here, a very simple example, right? Dogs are four-legged animals. Does that mean that there can't be a dog that has three legs? No, of course there can be dogs with only three legs, right? Tragic accidents happen, right? It's just that having only three legs instead of four legs is an imperfection for a dog, right? Why? Because it can't engage in the kinds of operations or activities that are uniquely characteristic of dogs, right? A three-legged dog can't run the way a four-legged dog can. And so possessing all of the characteristic traits or features of a thing is a further perfection beyond, right? Three-legged dogs exist. They have the first level of perfection. Four-legged dogs exist and have all the limbs that are sort of appropriate and fitting for dogs. The third and final level of perfection is on account of attaining its end or its purpose, right? So I grew up with golden retrievers, and it is absolutely unambiguous what the biological function of a golden retriever is. It is to retrieve, right? And those dogs are golden retrievers are like wonderful dogs in general. They're tail wagging when they see you. They're tail wagging when they're alone, right? Like they're happy creatures, right? But never is a golden happier than when it is running after a ball or a stick or a bird or a squirrel, right? And then bringing it back to you, right? And literally everything about the biology of a golden retriever is ordered for it to engage in that function. And so you can have a four-legged golden. That's not retrieving, right? It has perfection level one, it exists. It has perfection level two. It's got all of the traits and features that are typical and characteristic of golden retrievers, but it's still missing something. Why is that dog not maximally happy? Because it's not retrieving, right? It's like stuck in a cage or something, right? Everything is like that. And so everything admits of these three tiers of perfection. So we can think about things as good, right? That's the transcendental sense. Just like everything, every being is good, every good thing is a being. But then we can think of the goodness of that being minimally as its existence. Better to be than not to be. Then we can think of a kind of greater goodness of having the proper or characteristic traits, right? There are certain features that dogs should have and cats should not. There are certain features that cats should have and dogs should not. But the ultimate goodness of something is having all of that and then achieving its final end, engaging in the sort of maximal activities characteristic of that thing. Now, all of that I want to suggest to you, we can apply to fantasy and particularly to answering our core question. So the core question was, is grimdark fantasy less true, less good than other fantasy subgenres, and in particular than classical fantasy like Tolkien? And we divided that into two sub-questions. Is it less true? Is it less good? So let's apply the nuances of Aquinas' account of truth and apply the nuances of his account of goodness and give a principled Thomistic answer. So more than just my gut. First, is it less true? Answer, no, right? So the Catholic priest in me is upset, right? I wanted it to be yes, but actually it's no. At least the answer is no with respect to the essence of grimdark fantasy literature. Grimdark fantasy is not necessarily less true than classic fantasy. Why? Well, here's an argument. All art is true to the extent that it measures up to what its maker had in mind. That's like a core element of Aquinas' account. But guess what? Grimdark fantasy literature is art. Ergo, grimdark fantasy literature is true to the extent that it measures up to what its maker, i.e. its author, has in mind. But there's nothing about grimdark fantasy that requires it to measure up to the mind of its maker less than any other fantasy genre, right? There's no reason why. So granted that George R. R. Martin is writing within the subgenre of grimdark, there's no good reason for thinking that somehow because he's writing grimdark fantasy literature, Martin is somehow less able to successfully express what he has in mind in his novels than Tolkien is able to successfully express what he had in mind in his novels. Actually, on the way over here, a couple of us were talking about a really interesting case in which Tolkien manifestly failed to adequately express in his novels what he had in mind. Because Tolkien himself went back and forth about whether the race of orcs are they beasts or are they rational animals, right? Part of him, right, and part of the way that he wrote made it seem like they're beasts, right? So people morally non-problematically attempt genocide against the entire race of orcs, right? And no character thinks to themselves like, are we sure we should be doing this, right? Like, no, they're like, the killing of orcs within the story is exactly like the killing of dragons, is exactly like the killing of, you know, wargs. It's like, these are just beasts that are existential threats that can be slaughtered without moral reflection. And then there's this infamous scene where Frodo and Sam overhear a conversation between two orcs who have them captive. That sure looks like they're rational, intelligent, free creatures with like moral dignity and, you know, are not the kinds of things that one can blithely slay. So there was, and Tolkien in his letters expresses angst about this, right? So there's something in Lord of the Rings that wasn't resonating with the mind of the maker, right? I don't know if George R. R. Martin, well, no, there, George R. R. Martin actually had a conversation with another author where he asked, like, have you ever killed off a character and then realized that you like really needed that character later on? And the other author said, no, I've never done that. And he's like, oh, I did that, right? But there's nothing about grimdark fantasy that means that you're more likely to make a mistake like that and fail to express what you have in mind than any other kind of fantasy literature. Which means there's nothing about grimdark fantasy that requires it to be less true than another fantasy subgenre. What about goodness? Here, I want to suggest to you that the answer is yes, and it's yes essentially and necessarily. So yes, grimdark fantasy is less good essentially and necessarily than other fantasy subgenres. But good, it's less good in only one sense of goodness. And note, we've seen four senses of goodness in Aquinas. So why? Well, here's the argument. All art is good to the extent that it is rightly ordered to God as its final end. But grimdark fantasy literature cannot be rightly ordered to God as its final end. Ergo, grimdark fantasy literature cannot be good in the fullest and ultimate sense, right? So the final end sense. So remember, there's sense one, transcendental, kind of trivial. Sense two, existence, right? So better to be than not to be. Sense three, having all the characteristics, all the features and traits that are characteristic of the sort of thing that is in question. And then the fourth and final, the ultimate sense of goodness, is how having all of that and doing what it's ultimately supposed to do. Okay, so I've given you an argument. It's kind of a heavy-handed argument. So why should we think that the two premises that lead to the conclusion are actually true? So why should we think first that all art is good to the extent that it's rightly ordered to God as its final end? And why should we think that grimdark fantasy literature can't be thusly ordered? Well, here are three proofs of premise one. I'm a philosopher, so I trade in arguments. The nature argument. Nature is essentially ordered to God as its final end. Art essentially and necessarily imitates nature. Ergo, art is necessarily and essentially ordered to God as its final end. The human argument goes like this. Human action is essentially ordered to God as its final end, but art, i.e. human creativity, is a kind of human action. Ergo, art is essentially ordered to God as its final end. And a third, most universal argument that's equally ham-fisted. Everything is essentially ordered to God as its final end. Art is a thing, so art is essentially ordered to God as its final end. As ham-fisted as that last one is, I don't think that makes it any less true, right? So it's either true or it's false that creation is ordered to its creator. And it's either true or it's false that the world in which we live is creation. If it is in fact true that this world we live in is a creation, and it is in fact true that it's ordered to its creator, then literally everything, including the kinds of human, the expressions of human creativity that we have, are in fact ultimately ordered to God as their final end. What about the second premise? So this is the one that says grimdark fantasy can't be ordered to God as its final end. Well, here's an argument from Michael Sullivan's description of grimdark, right? So just go back to the very beginning of the talk. The argument goes like this. Anything that presents as true the idea that, quote, there is no possibility for joy and no reason to aspire to anything because in the end there is no chance of a better life or a greater good, close quote. Anything that presents that as true can't be rightly ordered to God as its final end. Why? Because God didn't make the world like that. Right? That's not actually how the world is. That's not an actual reflection of the moral order or the cosmic order. But that's precisely what grimdark fantasy does. It presents that idea as true. Ergo, it, so the subgenre itself, essentially and necessarily cannot be rightly ordered to God as its final end. Likewise, you can give an argument from Liz Bork's description slash definition, right? So anything the defining characteristic of which is the retreat into the valorization of darkness for darkness's sake, into a kind of nihilism that portrays right action in terms of personal morality as either impossible or futile, that can't be rightly ordered to God as its final end. Why? Because that's not right. That's not true. But that's what grimdark fantasy does. That's the defining characteristic of grimdark fantasy, right? Like, look, there are plenty of fantasies that have, like, dark things happen in them, right? That doesn't make them grimdark, right? There are plenty of fantasies that have, like, important characters die and not be returned to life or something like that. Tragedy isn't the same as grimdark, right? So if we're going to take actual living fantasy authors' actual definitions and characterizations of grimdark seriously, then at least as described by them, it's incompatible with that third sense of goodness. That doesn't mean it's incompatible with the first or the second or the third sense of goodness. Grimdark fantasy can have all of the proper traits that are characteristic of and good-making for fantasy literature, right? Grimdark fantasy can have a fantastic plot. Grimdark fantasy can have incredibly subtle, interesting characters. Grimdark fantasy can have captivating prose, right? All of that is good at the second level, the third level of goodness, right? So I'm not arguing that grimdark fantasy is essentially or necessarily thoroughgoingly bad, right? What I am saying is that as a subgenre, it is necessarily and essentially less good than classic fantasy. Why? Because classic fantasy as a subgenre is at least in principle able to fulfill all four levels of goodness. Whereas grimdark, in principle, is essentially and necessarily unable to fulfill the third. So, yes, Tolkien is better. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.